Welcome to session 5 of our series, The Audacity of Jesus, How Jesus Defied Convention and Invites Us to Do the Same. One of the trickiest questions a person can be asked on a job interview is, what is one of your greatest weaknesses? Your mind might quickly shuffle through a list of different options. Should I tell them that I have trouble showing up to work on time? No boss likes that one. How about I give them something more palatable? I'm just too nice to people. Yeah, that might work. Or perhaps I'm kind of a workaholic. Those are some of the character defects that a potential employer might get along with just fine. I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt. I trust that most of you want to be honest with your responses, but perhaps you've experienced some fear of being misunderstood. And maybe you've been concerned that a potential employer will see those deficiencies and make them out to be something bigger than they are. Or perhaps you've been afraid that a potential employer won't fully appreciate some of the personal strengths and technical skills that you can bring to a job. A lot of you likely consider yourself a long way from a job interview, but we all find ourselves in relationships where we feel overlooked and undervalued. Perhaps it's because people overinflate a character flaw that you have. Maybe it's because there is something good about you that people don't notice. Or maybe it's simply because you find yourself misunderstood. The problem is that we often try to take control in situations like that. When we feel overlooked, we jump in and remind people of our experience or our expertise and come across as arrogant or insecure. When we assume that people look down on us, some of us lash out and others build up resentments. We want to be known. We want to be understood. And there are a lot of ways that can happen in healthy relationships without imposing upon people. But Jesus relied on a tool that is often overlooked because it seems so counterintuitive: mystery. How did Jesus use mystery to surprisingly show the world who he was? And is that something we ought to consider for ourselves? Several times throughout the book of Mark, Jesus commands people to be quiet about what they have just seen and heard. This is known as the messianic secret. Carefully consider the following times Jesus does this in the book of Mark. Why do you think Jesus asks these different groups to remain quiet? In Mark chapter 1, verses 24 through 25, a demon cries out, "What do you want to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." "Be quiet," said Jesus sternly. "Come out of him." Later in the same chapter, Mark explains in verse 34, "And Jesus healed many who had various diseases. He also drove out many demons, but he would not let the demons speak because they knew who he was." Mark chapter 3, verses 11 through 12 says, "Whenever the impure spirits saw him, they fell down before him and cried out, 'You are the Son of God.' But he gave them strict orders not to tell others about him." When Peter confessed to Jesus that he was the Messiah in Mark chapter 8, verse 30, Jesus responded by warning them not to tell anyone about him. Then finally, in Mark chapter 9, verse 9, after Jesus took Peter, James, and John to see him transfigured, Mark writes this, "And they were coming down the mountain, Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had been risen from the dead." Why was Jesus so intent on keeping others quiet about who he was and what he did? Some claim that Jesus was simply trying to avoid being killed prematurely. Jesus was pretty practical. And the book of John lists this as a reason for his travel path in John chapter 7, verse 1, which says, "After this, Jesus went around in Galilee. He did not want to go about in Judea because the Jewish leaders there were looking for a way to kill him." The problem with this is that Mark never cites it as a reason, and it is in Mark that the messianic secret is most prominent. Perhaps Jesus was using a form of reverse psychology to get the message out. But it would be dangerous to question Jesus' sincerity. Mark wouldn't have wanted to portray Jesus as manipulative when one of his major goals was to make a case for him in his book? I think that the answer is in Mark chapter 9, verse 9. But before we go there, what exactly was Jesus trying to hide? In the first verse we consider, Jesus tells some demons to be quiet after they called him the Holy One of God. A few verses later, in chapter 1, verse 34, Mark tells us that Jesus wouldn't let demons speak because they knew who he was. So we know that Jesus' secret has to do with his identity, specifically his role as the Holy One of God, whatever that means. In Mark chapter 3, verses 11 through 12, the demons called him the Son of God. Jesus orders the demons to be silent. In Mark chapter 8, verse 30, Peter calls Jesus the Messiah, and Jesus tells the disciples not to tell anyone. So we have three titles: Holy One of God, Son of God, and Messiah. At face value, those three titles seem to be saying vastly different things about Jesus, but that's not the case. The most mysterious of the titles is the Holy One of God. God is often called the Holy One in the Old Testament, but never the Holy One of God. Holy is a word that is applied to many things, like God's people, God's temple, and the hill on which God's city sat. It simply means special or unique. Jesus was the special, unique one sent by God. Messiah is the Hebrew word for anointed one. In the Old Testament, kings were some of the most prominent figures that were anointed with oil at their installation ceremony. So the word basically became a way of referring to the king. In Psalm 2:2, David writes, "The kings of the earth and the rulers band together against the Lord and his anointed, Messiah." When modern listeners hear the title Son of God, they think of Jesus' place within the Trinity. But many Jews in Jesus' day would have had a different understanding of that title. They may have thought of the special covenant God made with David and his heirs in 2 Samuel 7:14, where God said, "I will be his father and he will be my son." Son of God was an expression Jews sometimes used to refer to the king God appointed to rule beneath him. And it's sometimes used this way in the New Testament. The disciple Nathanael said to Jesus, "You are the Son of God, you are the King of Israel," in John chapter 1, verse 49. That does not mean that the Son of God doesn't sometimes mean more than that. Son of God may sometimes refer to Jesus' special place within the Trinity. But the secret Jesus was trying to keep was one and the same. He is the one God chose and sent to be the people's king. This brings us back to our question: why did Jesus want to keep his kingship a secret in the first place? Let's revisit Mark chapter 9, verse 9. In this scene, Jesus goes up to the mountain. His clothes become dazzling white. Moses and Elijah appear by his side. Peter says something silly. A cloud appears to cover them, and a voice said from the cloud, "This is my son, whom I love. Listen to him." Then Jesus came down and he ordered them not to tell anyone what they had seen, which surely includes what they had just heard. But he adds a time limit on that prohibition: until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. There's a lot of connective tissue to the kingship of Jesus and the resurrection of the dead, more than we can explore here, but something important about the resurrection that is often overlooked is the fact that God is the one who raised him. Jesus has authority to take up his life again in John 10:18, but that authority is derived from the Father. That's why almost all the language about resurrection in the New Testament says that he was raised instead of saying he raised himself. It was a special act of God. Romans 1:4 says that he was appointed by the resurrection of the dead. 1 Corinthians 15:4 says that Christ was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures. The kingship of Jesus could only be revealed in the proper time by the proper authority in the proper way, and that was through the resurrection. Let's put ourselves in Jesus' place. He wrestled with demons, he fought against religious folk, and he struggled to get the disciples on the same page. But he waits halfway through the book to even ask his disciples who they think he is. And then he tells them to be quiet about it. From a human perspective, it might have seemed a lot easier to come out with it at the beginning. But Jesus was convinced that there was something that only God could reveal in his time and in his way. It's hard to say what the purpose of Jesus' strategy was here, but perhaps he found it important to lead with a personal touch instead of all the authority and power that came with him. He wanted to demonstrate the way we should live and modeled as much when he told his disciples, "The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many," in Mark 10:45. Recently, a commissioner of the Port Authority in New Jersey did the opposite. She was caught on video berating police officers for pulling over a vehicle with her daughter in it. The police officer tried to calm her down and began with, "Miss," but the woman interrupted, "No, don't call me Miss. I'm commissioner." The video was released and the woman resigned. Jesus didn't start out with, "I'm the king, come follow me." He simply started out with, "Come follow me." A little mystery created some space for him to move and build relationships, whereas the full truth could have turned people away. But Jesus' kingship wasn't the only secret Jesus kept in the book of Mark. There was another he was hiding in plain sight. Jesus' favorite title for himself through the Gospels was the Son of Man. The title appears 14 times in Mark alone. Consider the following instances where Jesus calls himself the Son of Man in Mark. What do you think the title means based upon the way Jesus used it? Jesus said, "The Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins," in Mark 2:10. He said, "The Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath," in Mark 2:28. He taught the disciples that the Son of Man must suffer many things, be killed, and after 3 days rise again, in Mark 8:31. He said that the Son of Man would be ashamed of anyone who is ashamed of his words when he comes in the Father's glory with his holy angels, in Mark 8:38. Jesus told his disciples not to speak of the transfiguration until the Son of Man had risen from the dead, in Mark 9:9. In Mark 9:12, 9:31, 10:33, 10:45, 14:21, and 14:41, Jesus again says that the Son of Man must suffer and die. Jesus said to his disciples in Mark 13:26, "At that time people will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory." And finally, when asked by the high priest if he was the Messiah, Jesus responded by saying, "I am, and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven," in Mark 14:62. When most modern Christians think of this unique title of Jesus, the Son of Man, they think of it rather simply. Jesus is a son of man, a person, a human being. So Jesus is a human being. That rather obvious fact took on heightened importance in the decades and centuries after the Bible was written because many people rose up questioning whether Jesus was a human at all. But nobody questioned the humanity of Jesus when he lived among them. Everyone assumed it. It wasn't a problem that needed to be addressed. So it would be a little out of place for Jesus to choose a title just to remind everyone he was a human being. In the Old Testament and in other ancient literature, Son of Man is used as a general expression to refer to someone. God addresses the prophet Ezekiel frequently with this expression. In ancient Proverbs, it is used as a way of speaking about a person generally, some so-and-so or average Joe. What makes Jesus' use of the expression different, however, is that he applies it to himself, which is not something other people did. So if there was no immediate need for Jesus to convince people that he was a person, and if it made as much sense for someone to call themselves the Son of Man back then as it does for someone to adopt the name Mr. So-and-so today, why did Jesus call himself this? We should first note that Jesus referred to himself as the Son of Man in theologically pregnant statements. The Son of Man has authority to forgive sins. He is Lord of the Sabbath. He is the one predicted in scriptures to suffer, be killed, and rise again in 3 days. He is the one that the people will see coming on the clouds with great power and glory. What is perhaps most important, however, are the two instances that Jesus referred to himself as the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory in Mark 13:26 and 14:62. Jesus is actually alluding to specific Old Testament prophecies. One is in Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 through 14. "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and people of every language worshipped him. Another is Psalm 110, verse 1, where David describes another Lord sitting at the right hand of God. Both of these texts point to a figure who eventually became known as the Son of Man in some Jewish traditions, who shared unique power with God, had a level of equality with him because of where he sat, rode clouds, which was often a symbol of divine status in the ancient Near East, and was worshipped. Jewish writers like the author of 1 Enoch and others picked up on this tradition and described a powerful supernatural figure like God, but in some way distinct from God. So before Jesus even showed up, there were hints about a powerful divine figure distinct from the Father and yet worshipped like him. These hints stemmed in part from this figure from Daniel 7 that became known as the Son of Man. What's fascinating about this is that Jesus' disciples, who weren't exactly Bible scholars, probably would have missed the cues. But the last time Jesus used the title of himself was when he was surrounded by the Bible scholars of his day, and they got it. During the trial of Jesus, the Jewish leaders were openly trying to kill him. When they finally brought him before a secret tribunal, Mark writes that they were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death, but they could not find any. Finally, after several failed attempts, a thought comes to the high priest. Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One? The high priest thought that he could get the Messiah on charges of sedition. The Jews lived under the hand of Rome at the time, and Caesar was their king, whether they liked it or not. But if the high priest could get Jesus to admit publicly that he was the king instead, he could make a case to the Roman authorities that Jesus was trying to claim Caesar's throne and get Jesus killed as a result. What's important to know is that there were no Jewish laws prohibiting someone from making a claim to the throne. The Jews only wanted to capture Jesus, breaking the Roman laws so that they could deal with him as they desired. With a simple, I am, Jesus gives the high priest exactly what he's looking for. For the first time, Jesus publicly confesses one of the secrets he was holding back, that he was indeed God's chosen king. If that had been all that Jesus said, the high priest and Jewish leaders would have simply taken him to Pilate, and Mark would have probably ended the scene there. But Jesus continues with that remarkable allusion to Daniel chapter 7 and Psalm 110. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. Jesus wasn't claiming to be a human king. Jesus was claiming to be the divine figure with God's power, status, and the right to be worshipped. Jesus wasn't just breaking Roman law. He was dishonoring God from their viewpoint in the most egregious way. The high priest tears his clothes and cries blasphemy. The people spit at him and struck him, agreeing that he was worthy of death. Jesus was way more than a man, and he lets the people know by telling him that he is the Son of Man. Jesus was far more open about being the Son of Man, a seemingly more contentious title, than he was about being the king. But that title was shrouded in mystery. No one cried blasphemy until Jesus put it in its proper theological context, and until he said it to the right crowd. Even though Jews had begun the conversation about figures sharing God's power and sitting at his right hand, the Jewish people weren't suddenly prepared to totally reshape their concept of God. The Jesus that Mark presents is one who slowly reveals that he is God in subtle and mysterious ways to a people who wouldn't have been able to take it all in at once. And the only time he violated that principle was when it was time for him to go. Not only did Jesus use mystery to create some space to move and build relationships with people, he used mystery to slowly reveal some complex and difficult truths that would have been hard to take in all at once. Jesus took baby steps to reveal the most controversial thing about himself, that he was somehow both God and distinct from his Father in heaven. Strive Masiwa is an engineer who transformed the telecommunications landscape in Africa. In his interview at the 2018 Global Leadership Summit, he said that he told his people he wanted to connect all the countries in Africa, and they looked at him with shock. He reevaluated and decided to present them with short-term achievable goals instead. "Let's connect South Africa and Zimbabwe," he said. The team got it, and they achieved it. 15 years later, they connected Cairo on the opposite end of the continent. Sometimes we have to take baby steps too. When we rush to share our stories, we can overwhelm people. Perhaps you went through some life-defining tragedy or carry some scarlet letter. You hunger to build an authentic, meaningful connection with someone, and you want to get all the hard stuff out of the way, but hard things deserve to be shared at the proper time and place. Leaving a little mystery in your stories can be an asset. People need to know that you are human, that you are like them, before you share with them something that makes things a little bit more complex. Jesus demonstrated wisdom by waiting for God to reveal his purpose and by slowly preparing people for his paradigm-shifting identity. He did this even when it would have been more convenient to share everything up front. But the shortest path isn't always the best one, and Jesus invites us to consider how we too might be content with a little mystery in our own lives to build bridges more effectively as well. We spent the last 5 sessions exploring the audacity of Jesus, ways Jesus went against the grain, rattled authorities, surprised his listeners, created tension, and squeezed into tiny spaces to create colorful moments. In many ways, Jesus was inviting us to live a little more on the fringe. He challenges our sensibilities and calls us to live a little strangely on occasions that merit it. Jesus rewrote the rules when he interacted with people and encourages us to cast aside normal as something to strive for. He invites us to be different, not simply for the sake of being different, but for the good of the kingdom and the glory of his Father in heaven. But the strange, wonderful life of Jesus is more than an invitation to sometimes embrace the odd as a way of encouraging people to follow after God. It's an invitation to worship the completely unique God-man who charted a course unlike any other and still provokes our curiosity today. We want to emulate Jesus' character. We want to consider some of his unique methods. But ultimately, we have to recognize that we can't ever be Jesus. And the only proper response to this one whom the earth was created through, whom souls were saved for, and whose unbreakable love we enjoy, is to worship.